The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Florence Nash from Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from... I'm certainly going to start off with the December-January issue of AARP Magazine. And our programming today is generously underwritten by Celebi Chiropractic. Celebi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call them at 919-782-4733. That's 919-782-4733. Now, last week we were reading the AARP magazine cover story, which was about Smokey Robinson and the story of Motown, the record label that changed the world, turned 60. And we had to quit in the middle of an article, or part two of a series of articles on Motown. And this was about how Berry Gordy opened a studio that broke barriers in popular music. For the first time, he mixed black and white artists and had fantastic success in creating the Motown sound, but his artists had some problems as they began touring. As they got to be very popular and toured the United States with their acts, they did run into problems with a still segregated society. And so we're going to pick up in the middle of this article where we had to quit. And the last thing we've been talking about is in the article was the groups touring and running in the South, running into whites-only signs and social separations that made life hard on the road. Meanwhile, as Detroit was trying to recover, Gordy moved his main operation to a larger, safer building downtown. His artists hated it. Worse, some were close to hitless without the magic of the Holland Dozier Holland songwriting team, who had departed the label in 1968 amid a flurry of lawsuits and countersuits over royalties. From 1970 on, Berry wasn't really interested in the record business, observed his longtime marketing man and consigliere, Barney Ailes. In 1972, Gordy moved the company to Hollywood, setting up shop on Sunset Boulevard. He moved some of his blended family, he's been married and divorced three times and has eight children, into a home in the Hollywood Hills. Down the street, there was a smaller rental home for Diana Ross. Their long affair, the stuff of dream girls, was an open secret. Gordy was also candid about his desire to become a TV and movie mogul, with his protege draped in furs and acclaim. Miss Ross would star in Lady Sings the Blues and the regrettable Gordy-directed melodrama Mahogany. Back in Detroit, between 200 and 300 Motown employees had lost their jobs. Some, like the Contours' Joe Billingsley, went back to the factory floors. Others, like the Four Tops, found new recording deals. But something precious had been lost. Duke Faker, now 82 and the sole surviving original member of the Tops, says those still in Detroit were bereft. Motown was more than a brick and mortar. It was a huge part of our social life. We spent as much time there as we did at home. In Los Angeles, those adorable Jacksons helped carry the torch and the bottom line. In 1970, I'll Be There sold over 3 million copies. As disco, funk, and adult contemporary took hold, Motown signed that platform-booted super freak Rick James and the Commodores, a former student band fronted by Lionel Richie. But there was a steady stream of artist defections. Even Diana Ross left the label in 1981. I always knew I'd have to leave, Michael Jackson told me in 1982, as he was about to release his monster hit, Thriller, his second solo album on the Epic label. He explained that even as a child, he knew that the Motown studio system was too confining for his singular vision. Nonetheless, MJ said he was grateful for the homeschooling in Studio A. He studied the producers with a silent obsession, I was like a hawk praying in the night, he said. I'd watch everything. Like many showbiz dynasties, Motown has also seen its share of tragic deaths. Temptation Paul Williams fatally shot himself two blocks from Hitsville. The Supremes' Florence Ballard endured a heartrending spiral into depression and alcoholism and died of a heart attack at 32. Mary Wells lost her voice and her life to throat cancer at 49. A grieving Marvin Gaye could not perform live for 4 years after his duet partner, the stunning Tammy Terrell, collapsed in his arms on stage and died following brain surgery in 1970. Beset with drug problems, Gaye was shot to death by his father in 1984. Complications from substance abuse killed Temptation David Ruffin and Michael Jackson. They were all mourned like family by their label mates. Among the survivors of Motown's first generation, the road still beckons for some. Martha Reeves performs with two of her sisters acting as Latter-day Vandellas. Duke Faker and his Tops tour 35 weeks a year. Otis Williams, the last original Temptation, is still on the road with My Guys. There have been 22 replacements so far. Yes, audiences still insist on the Temps' razor-sharp choreography, but sorry, folks, no more spins and splits. Williams is 77 and admits that some nights he's bone-tired. Yet here I stay. All we ever wanted to do was just sing and make the girls happy. It did start out simply, as did Mr. Ford's basic Model T. In America, the product Gordy and his artist delivered was revolutionary in terms of black entrepreneurship and crossover clout. That loud, insistent backbeat was also heard worldwide. It prefigured today's global music while delivering lifelong memories to millions. Gordy's star-making machinery was primitive compared with today's algorithm-driven merchandising. But in Motown's frenzied boom years, Hitsville stamped out some remarkably durable goods. Solid state, still danceable and alluring, those blue-labeled 45s can claim the same honorific conferred on those other Detroit dream machines of yore, American classics. Now, part three in this series of articles on Motown is called The Hidden Figures of Hitsville. You've probably never heard of the Andantes, the girl group Motown left behind. Before we start this, though, there's a sidebar at the end of the one we just finished called of Motown Hit Moments from the Detroit Years. And it's good to have a little timeline reminder of what music came out when, so we'll read this first. 1959, Berry Gordy borrows $800 from his family savings club and starts Tamla Record Company. 1960, Motown releases its first hit single, Money, That's What I Want, sung by Barrett Strong. The Miracles, featuring Smokey Robinson, record Shop Around, the first Motown record to sell 1 million copies. In 1961, the Marvelettes release Please Mr. Postman. This was the first Motown song to reach the number one position on the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles chart. In 1962, the Contours release Do You Love Me, which was written for the Temptations. As Gordy was unable to locate the group, the song was given to the Contours. In 1963, Mary Wells appears on American Bandstand with Dick Clark. 1964, the Temptations' first top 20 hit is The Way You Do the Things You Do. 1965, six Motown releases reach number one, including I Can't Help Myself by the Four Tops and Stop in the Name of Love by the Supremes. 1966, Gladys Knight and the Pips, rising stars from Atlanta, sign a record deal with Motown. 1967, Martha and the Vandellas released Jimmy Mack on the Gordy label. 1968, Marvin Gaye's version of I Heard It Through the Grapevine hits number one on the pop chart. 1969, the Jackson 5 perform at the Daisy Disco in Los Angeles with an introduction by Diana Ross. 1970, Edwin Starr releases War. And 1971, Michael Jackson appears on the cover of Rolling Stone for the first time. And so now we go to Act 3, The Hidden Figures of Hittsville. This is written, this is the writer Touré. The church in their voices. What? Who? Can she sing? Marlene Barrow and Jackie Hicks sounded downright skeptical. It was the summer of 1961, and the young women, then 19 and 21 years old, respectively, were at the Motown Recording Studio on West Grand Boulevard in Detroit. Barrow, tall and slender, and Hicks, bubbly and full-figured, had grown up singing in the choir of the Hartford Avenue Baptist Church. They had been to the Motown studio before, had laid down some backup vocals at the fledgling label as two-thirds of a trio, but then the high soprano in their group had quit suddenly, and Barrow and Hicks weren't too interested in working without her. A studio staffer thinking of a young soprano in the studio's choral ensemble made a suggestion. We've got a girl in here who can sing. Barrow and Hicks had the same question. Can she sing? Oh, yeah, came the reply. She can sing. More than 50 years later, no one remembers which song the three worked on that day, but the new girl, Louvain Demps, a reserved Catholic woman of 23, still remembers how it went. We just seemed to click right away, she says. First time, Hicks adds. First song, perfect blend. That's how Louvain Demps joined the Andantes, which would become, perhaps, the most important singing group you've probably never heard of. The trio sang background on more than 20,000 Motown songs, upward of 90% of the company's output, before its 1972 move to Los Angeles. Theirs are the voices you can hear responding to Mary Wells in her 1964 hit, My Guy. What you say? Tell me more. They testified on Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine, and significantly, they provided the oohs and ahs and baby babies, the depth and sweetness on countless tracks where their separate voices can't even be picked out, except maybe by the women themselves. To this day, Hicks says she hears herself on the radio every single day. The Andantes' perfect blend was critical to the Motown sound, part of the secret seasoning that listeners could hear only on that label. These women, unsung in so many ways, were a key reason so many people loved Motown music. Yet most Motown fans still don't know the Andantes' story. Today, Hicks, 79, and Demps, 80, have returned to their old workplace, walking around the popular museum built on the site of the famed Hittsville, USA buildings. They remind me that their friend Marlene Barrow, the beloved peacemaker in the trio, whose married name was Barrow Tate, died in 2015 at age 73, so the group is now incomplete. Hicks, the Andantes alto, is wearing a green pantsuit with matching socks set off by pink sneakers. On first meeting, she seems serious, but that's only because she hasn't yet revealed the side of herself that marked her as the group's prankster, an identity she still seems to take pride in. During one recording session long ago, Demps recalls, she was having a minor issue with her part, and Hicks was holding what she thought was an empty water cup. I told her, I'm going to throw this water in your face if you don't get the song right, says Hicks, picking up the story. She just looked at me, so I said, boop, she says, as she pantomimes thrusting a cup forward. There was water in the cup. It was just running down her face. I was shocked. Demps laughed, adding, and I was wet. Yeah, you were, Hicks responds. Hey, one of these days I hope you forget that story. That's not likely. Demps is the historian of the group, the one who remembers who said what to whom most everything that happened to them in Studio A. She speaks in a high, breathy voice. Demps is the first soprano, after all, and has a sweet, delicate manner. She seems to end every sentence with a big smile, no matter what she's saying. That's true even when she's talking about the loss of second soprano Barrow Tate, their lifelong friend. Marlene was a jewel, Demp says. Jackie was funny and I was real quiet. Marlene was the one who would always patch things up, the one that would say, don't worry about it, it's going to be okay. I really loved her. When Motown stars and songwriters try to describe the musical debt they owe to the Andantes, they get downright religious. They could sing together like angels, says Martha Reeves, lead singer of Martha and the Vandellas. Ivy Jo Hunter, who wrote songs for Marvin Gaye, The Spinners, and Gladys Knight and the Pips, says, "It was a heavenly gift that they had. It's something that you really can't manufacture." Mickey Stevenson, Motown's first A&R man, describes their talent as a gift that's given by God. This reference to divinity is no coincidence. In the classic sound of the African-American church, the interplay between a lead singer and the rest of the choir, the call and response, creates a powerful structure that has tremendous emotional resonance. Motown's arrangers built on that structure, which originated in West Africa and is found in many genres of African-American music. Unlike in the white pop recordings of the same era, background vocalists at Motown didn't just harmonize on a song's choruses. They created a back and forth with the whole melody that deepened the listening experience. Berry Gordy may have sought to present a safe, apolitical version of his performers to appeal to a crossover audience, but he couldn't take the church out of their voices. The Andantes sang on Baby, I Need Your Loving by the Four Tops, Love Child by Diana Ross and the Supremes, For Once in My Life by Stevie Wonder, and countless other classics. They were on every song, Stevenson says, all the ones that were hits. In fact, the group was so critical to Motown's sound that if they weren't available, Stevenson would stop the session. If one of them wasn't feeling well, we would hold that tune until she felt better. I couldn't have done it without them. Like the label's house band, known as the Funk Brothers, whose distinctive grooves were always heard but never credited on early Motown records, the Andantes provided anonymous support for the label's biggest stars. For years, the three young women practically lived at the studio, called upon to record something new almost every day. They gave us a cozy office upstairs where we would stay overnight if we needed to, recalls Demps. Eventually, they were paid upward of $10 an hour. It was considered good money. We were family, Smokey Robinson says. We were kids growing up there together, and the Andantes were part of that family. Robinson used the women on many of the thousands of songs he wrote and produced, including My Guy for Mary Wells and My Girl for The Temptations. The Andantes were three of the greatest singers ever in life, he emphasizes. Any one of them could have been a lead singer or solo artist. The writer-producer Lamont Dozier used their voices to fill in the lead singer's parts and give the harmony more substance. If I had some very intricate background parts and the harmonies didn't have the sound that I wanted, I would tell the famous singers, "It's okay, we'll fix it in the mix." They would take a break, and I'd have the Andantes come in the back door, he notes, laughing. We like to call them the cleanup girls. They could always come in and fix whatever we couldn't fix with the big acts. Like family. Both Hicks and Demps say that despite the hard work and lack of public recognition, Motown was a loving atmosphere where almost everyone treated them with great respect. Did they sense any resentment from stars such as Diana Ross about being added to their tracks? Sometimes there was a little ill feelings, Hicks allows, but hey, it was what it was. It wasn't our choice. Producers loved the Andantes because they created their own arrangements on the spot. No easy thing. They could walk in that studio and lay that stuff down in 5 or 10 minutes, Stevenson says. If you had anybody else, it would take you a few hours. Demps wanted the Andantes to have their shot as featured recording artists, but it never seemed to come. Whenever the young women asked Motown staff about it, Barrow once recalled, they would be told to have patience. Maybe due to their persistence, the Andantes did record one single at Motown under their own name, the 1964 jump tune, Like a Nightmare. But they were never sent through Motown's storied artist development program to craft a stage presence, and when the single received no promotion, it quickly vanished from view. Why didn't Motown founder Berry Gordy ever try to make the Andantes stars? Was it because they were a few years older than the label's higher-profile girl groups? Was it because, as young mothers by then, both Barrow and Demps would have had difficulty going out on tour? Perhaps. But according to journalist Adam White, author of Motown, The Sound of Young America, there was also a business case to be made for keeping the Andantes under wraps. Berry Gordy was very protective of what he had, White says. He didn't want the names of the musicians to be out there so they could get offers that might tempt them to leave. Jacqueline Hicks hadn't planned to be a professional singer, neither had Marlene Barrow. In fact, as teens, they avoided working with a band leader who wanted to record with them, even hiding in the closet when he came to Hicks's home. "He asked my mother, 'Where are Jacqueline and Marlene?'" Hicks remembers. "She said, 'In the closet, hiding from you.'" He took it as a joke, so we opened the door and started laughing and came out. As we were going to the car, I said, "Mama, why would you tell on us?" She said, "How much money are you making in that closet?" Demps, by contrast, had always aspired to perform professionally. Raised in the Catholic Church, she was familiar with formal liturgical music, and her parents had always thought she should sing opera. Instead, Demps pursued pop, and though she was proud to be part of the Andantes, she wanted to perform under her own name, too. "I'm not saying that I wanted to be a star," Demps explains, "but I wanted more. I just wanted more." Life after Motown. Early in 1972, rumors were flying that the label was planning a move to Los Angeles. "We had heard it in the air," Barrow recounted in the 2007 book Motown from the Background. "We would ask them repeatedly if it were true. They would deny it. But when she and Hicks went to pick up their mid-January paychecks, there weren't any checks there for them." The two called Demps in the middle of the night in a panic, and the following day Demps went down to Motown to find out whether the label was leaving. When she was told that it was, she was outraged. She demanded that checks be cut for all three Andantes, and she had the head of the label's quality control department drive her to the bank to make sure hers cashed. "That's how we found out," Demps says. "I guess if they hadn't owed us money, they might not have said a word." Barrow and Hicks took the loss in stride. "They were trying to get into the movie thing," Hicks says of Berry Gordy's motivation. "They were going in a different direction." Hicks eventually landed a job at the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, and Barrow found employment with the Michigan Department of Labor. Demps took it much harder. She was a divorced mother of two young boys, and she feared rightfully that her dreams of stardom were ending. "For me, it was devastating," she says. "I just couldn't adjust. Our songs would come on the radio, and I'd cry." She left her hometown, moved to Atlanta, and found work at a Georgia State Center for Children with Intellectual Disabilities. "I loved working with the children," she points out. She was able to identify some non-disabled children at the center who had been caught up in the system, and she helped them to get out. "That softened my heart and kind of pulled me out of the dumps. There's a little passage in the Bible that says, 'And when he came to himself,' you know, when I came to myself, that's when I realized that I've wasted time being depressed when I should have been happy." Eventually, Demps began to sing again, doing commercial jobs as well as performing in church. In the early 1990s, the Andantes reunited in Detroit to sing for Motor City Records, an effort by a British producer to market the city's Motown-era acts. The company quickly failed, but not before the Andantes turned into a four-person group with the addition of their fellow Motown alumna Pat Lewis, recorded an album's worth of songs under their own name. Those sessions were the group's final foray into the studio together. In recent years, the Andantes have begun to receive the notice that many feel they ought to have had all along. Reissued Motown records now bear the Andantes' name if the women sang on them. After being paid a flat hourly fee during their recording years, the women are now receiving some residuals for their work. And in 2013, while Barrow Tate was still living, all three Andantes were able to visit an exhibit at the Motown Museum that celebrated the Supremes, the Vandellas, the Marvelettes, and, right alongside them, the Andantes. While she appreciates the belated recognition, Hicks says she would have been just as happy remaining in the background. "I've always been proud of myself and thankful to the Lord to have allowed me to do that," she notes. "I don't care how high anybody goes. It does not lower me any lower, because I know what I did." Now, we've just got 3 or 4 minutes left, so we'll do a couple of little shorty pieces from the personal best section. The first one is My Sport, Freestyle, by journalist T.R. Reid, who is 74 and the author of 10 books, including most recently A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. Our three-man team clambered onto the gondola at the base of the mountain. A young woman on the ski lift looked up at my gray hair, then down at my snowboard boots, and made a comment I've heard before. "You're the oldest snowboarder I've ever seen." She had a point. I was born a few weeks ahead of D-Day. But the two friends who were with me are hardly spring chickens either. Dick Zellner is 78, and Joe Potasik is 71. We three tend to move from one resort to another. In deciding where to go next, we naturally look for ski areas that offer soaring mountain vistas and a decent bar or two. But we also consider each resort's respect for the elderly, that is, how much of a price break we get. We first discovered this consideration a few years back at a mountain ski resort in New Mexico. As we approached the window to buy our lift tickets, a great day got even greater. A big sign read, 70 and over, ski free. Dick and I easily qualified for the free tickets, but Joe was a mere boy of 68 at the time, so he did not. Naturally, Joe made the argument that we're a team, we call ourselves the Medicare Ski Team, and thus should split the $70 cost of his lift ticket. We voted 2-1 not to do that. We three old friends have been hiking, biking, skiing, and drinking fine wines together for decades now. In summer, we used to climb mountains, but over time, those excursions became too strenuous for our aging joints, despite replacement parts. When snow season comes, though, we are still drawn to the slopes. As I'm zipping through a snowy glade on my board, I feel lucky that we live near the Rocky Mountains and can still enjoy them at our age. But I feel entitled, too. After decades of paying for the privilege, doggone it, we've earned those free lift tickets. Now, I'm thinking that AARP might be planning an issue on Woodstock, because here's a little announcement down here in the margins. It says, "Remember Woodstock? If you were at the 1969 Music Festival in upstate New York, or if Woodstock helped create a lasting memory for you, we'd like to hear all about it. Please send us the details, a photo of yourself, and a photo of any relic or souvenir you have from the event, either by email to mywoodstock@aarp.org or by regular mail to mywoodstock, AARP, the magazine, 601 East Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20049. And now we have gotten to the time where we need to wind up today's episode of Modern Maturity. I hope that you're going to come back and listen to us again next week and that you've enjoyed it today. I'm Florence Nash, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is generously underwritten by Celebi Chiropractic, which welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call them at 919-782-4733. That's 919-782-4733. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, do give us a call at 919-832-5138.